you have to prove to some fact that loss of habitat is going to translate into some reduction in numbers. The government simply did not do that in this case.
Arguments in court over the fate of polar bears. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 23rd of February. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, two new exciting fossil finds in Denali National Park.
Denali has just proven candy riches beyond our expectations.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ANSEP, the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, where every year Alaska Natives from all corners of the state graduate and become engineers, scientists, and physicians. Students can get involved as early as middle school, then move to the University of Alaska Anchorage, Fairbanks, or Southeast in a program based on skill building, collaboration, and community. Learn more at ANSEP.net. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program.
Whether the polar bear is endangered, threatened, or doing just fine was debated in federal court today in Washington, D.C. Lawyers for the federal government defended the 2008 U.S. Fish and Wildlife decision to list the bears as threatened, meaning they're at risk of becoming endangered in the future. But they were challenged from both sides. The state of Alaska and other groups argued that the bears shouldn't be protected at all, while the Wildlife Conservation Group Center for Biological Diversity argued that the bears are already endangered because the sea ice on which they hunt for seals is melting. The center's senior counsel, Brendan Cummings, says the purpose of their case is to establish that polar bears are in danger of extinction.
By designating the polar bear as threatened rather than endangered, in essence, the government is saying global warming is a future threat, that we don't really need to worry about it now, that we have a few decades to begin our action. And that's just the wrong approach. It's wrong as a matter of science, it's wrong as a matter of law. So we're seeking to get the polar bear properly classified as an endangered species to represent the very real threat that it already faces today.
CBD showed photographs of a starving bear and bears so hungry they had turned to cannibalism. They say ice is melting so fast that in as little as 15 years, female bears won't be on the ice long enough to develop the body fat necessary to reproduce. CBD also argued that Fish and Wildlife violated the law by not using the best science available and came to conclusions not supported by the facts.
The current Fish and Wildlife Service position is the bears in Alaska don't matter. As long as there's some bears surviving in high Arctic Canada, we can lose all the bears in Alaska, we can lose all the bears in Hudson Bay, all the bears in Russia, but hey, there'll still be some bears somewhere, so that's okay. That's not okay. And we're hoping if we can prevail in this court case, the government will actually have to look at polar bears on a population level and afford them the protection in the places they actually exist, such as Alaska.
But the state of Alaska says the bear shouldn't be listed at all because there is not a population decline. It's concerned that protections for the bear could hamper oil and gas development. The state's endangered species coordinator, Doug Vincent Lang, says some amount of sea ice melt doesn't prove that the bears are threatened.
Let's say you have a 2,200 square foot house and there's four people living in it. Well, if for some reason now you're in a 1,200 foot square foot house, you could still have four people living in it. So you have to prove to some fact that loss of habitat is going to translate into some reduction in numbers. The government simply did not do that in this case.
The attorney who argued on behalf of the state of Alaska, Murray Feldman, says one problem is that the Fish and Wildlife Service didn't adequately consult with the state before making its decision, which is required by law. He says that's reason enough to throw out the threatened listing. He also tried to poke holes in the agency's decision.
The service, when they listed the polar bear, didn't make a rational connection between the information they had before them and the decision that they made, and we were focused primarily on the population projections and modeling that the service used to predict habitat losses and whether that rose to the level of a threat under the Endangered Species Act.
Federal attorney Clifford Stevens defended the threatened listing and dismissed both sides' criticisms about the bear population models used, saying far more information went into the Fish and Wildlife decision than just modeling. He says the threatened listing is rational because the bear is indeed likely to be in danger of extinction in the future, but isn't right now. Stevens called the polar bear a classic case of exactly what Congress intended the threatened category to be used for when they created it. The federal attorneys refused interviews with APRN. The hearing today was a melding of numerous cases related to the polar bear listing, so a variety of other groups also made arguments, like the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation. Its attorney, Jeff Feldman, sided with the federal government. He says while the Inupiat residents are concerned about the implications of even a threatened listing, the corporation believes the government's arguments are sound. But Feldman says they do want to make sure the feds don't go further.
My purpose is to make sure that the arguments advanced by the Center for Biological Diversity that the polar bear should be classified as endangered is rejected by the court. We believe that argument is not based on the science, on good science, and that it's an attempt to impose on the natives on the North Slope burdens that they should not have to bear as a consequence of the Center for Biological Diversity's to make a political issue out of greenhouse gas effects.
District Court Judge Emmett Sullivan heard the arguments. His decision could come any time in the next few months. He did not give attorneys a sense of when he will rule. University of Alaska Fairbanks faculty and staff met last night to vent concerns and anger over the administration's proposals to hike the cost of university health insurance. Anchorage campus faculty and staff will meet over the issue on Thursday. University employees statewide are facing higher deductibles, higher premiums, higher prescription copays, and many other cost increases under a set of proposals unveiled earlier this month. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
The 80-some faculty and staff members packed into a UAF conference room strongly disagreed with the administration's proposed solutions on rising health care costs. Cynthia Hardy, an associate professor of developmental studies, English, and women's studies, summed up the general feeling when she said faculty and staff ought to speak out and let the administration know that the workers are ready to rise up in protest, like people in the Middle East.
And you need to let them know we're mad as hell. We're not going to take it anymore. We're going to go Egypt.
University administrators say employees must pay more for health insurance and that benefits must be reduced to help the university cut health care costs by nearly $8 million in the coming fiscal year, and to hold down soaring costs in the years to come. One administration consultant says those rising costs could, in 7 years, double the university's current $65 million annual health insurance price tag. Melanie Arthur, a UAF sociology instructor and Faculty Joint Health Care Committee member, says the administration isn't working with the faculty and its union, United Academics, to help solve the problem. Rather, it's just dumping the problem onto the backs of faculty and staff.
Because I think the big picture here is a massive cost shift. It doesn't address the rising costs. It moves the costs onto employees from administration. And it doesn't just move costs onto employees, it moves costs onto the employees who are sick. That's where your costs are. The out-of-pocket costs are going up by up to 6 times.
Healthcare committee members and many others at Tuesday's meeting complained that the administration hasn't dealt fairly with faculty and staff and refuses to meet further and negotiate, and instead has dictated the healthcare changes. Some of those at the meeting also expressed frustration with faculty union representatives, who they say traded the union's ability to negotiate healthcare cost increases for concessions in salary increases. A UAF administrator who's been at the forefront of the healthcare proposals disagrees with those accusations and says the administration has reached out to faculty and staff. Beth Boehner, UAF's chief human resources officer, said today the administration has followed its usual regime of meeting with faculty representatives on the university's Joint Healthcare Committee and has communicated to employees through mail, email, and online postings.
We have a prescribed way of hearing input from employees who are represented by unions, and that is that we have a joint health care committee that works to provide employee input to the university management for all types of health care issues.
Boehner says the administration was aware of faculty concerns over the health care proposals, but faculty representatives on the Joint Health Care Committee couldn't get enough votes to compel the administration to change the proposals.
But in this case, after working extensively with our Joint Health Care Committee, they were not able to get the votes to recommend any specific plan modification.
Boehner says the proposed changes for the coming fiscal year are essentially a done deal now, but she says employees should weigh in on proposed plan changes for fiscal 2013. Those include other controversial changes, such as a spousal surcharge and additional charges for so-called high-risk behaviors, such as riding a motorcycle or scuba diving. The proposals also include mandatory biometric reporting, which would track policyholders' weight and level of conditioning, for example. Joe Hickman, director of UAF's Student Services, spoke for many Tuesday night when he said he'd rather not send any confidential data to Consovo.
In 6 days, I have to send this stuff off to Colorado, some company I've never heard of.
Many said Tuesday they'd refuse to provide the confidential data out of a concern that it could be lost or stolen by identity thieves. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Iron Dog racers confront unusual conditions on the trail.
The snow was so deep, we were crawling through places that we're really moving through normally.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Interior Regional Native Corporation Doyon is looking favorably on changes to a federal program that funnels federal contracts worth billions of dollars to Alaska Native corporations. The Small Business Administration's 8A program has announced new regulations aimed at eliminating waste, fraud, and abuse in the no-bid contract program for disadvantaged companies. Doyon's Senior Vice President and Chief Operating Officer Aaron Schutt says changes suggested by Doyon, Arctic Slope, and Nana Regional Corporation are reflected in the new rules.
That match up with our three themes in our reform proposal are accountability, enforcement, and competition. And there are a number of changes in the regulations that fall in those three categories.
The 8A program drew major scrutiny in Congress that resulted in calls for its elimination or reform. One criticism was that too much of the non-competitive contract money awarded to Native corporations was going to non-Native companies partnered with to do the work. Schutt says the issue is addressed in the new regulations.
Those criticisms of the program, which we think are very valid, the SBA took that on head-on in the final regulations and required a higher percentage of work to be done by the 8A firm itself, and also put a lot of other protections in place in those areas of the regulations. And that goes to both the accountability and the enforcement of the rules sections of our proposal that we like.
Schutt says the separate issue of subcontracting by 8A recipients to non-Native companies is covered by better enforcement of existing regulations, but that the new rules do require improved reporting of the benefits of 8A contracts to shareholders. Schutt says Doyon has only been a minimal participant in the no-bid 8A program, but does have major federal security and construction contracts in the lower 48 and Alaska, including a several billion-dollar 50-year contract to run utilities on interior military bases. A Homer fisherman who was a deckhand for the fishing vessel Time Bandit and was one of the stars of the Discovery Channel series Deadliest Catch was found dead Tuesday afternoon in a hotel room. Police say they do not suspect foul play in the death of 33-year-old Justin Tennyson. KBBI's Aaron Selbig has more.
Justin K. Tennyson was found dead in his room at the Best Western Bidarka Inn Tuesday after a member of the hotel's cleaning staff became suspicious when he did not check out of his room. A maintenance man discovered Tennyson's body and reported it to Homer Police at 12:52 p.m. Homer Police Department Lieutenant Randy Rosencrantz says police do not suspect foul play in Tennyson's death, but their investigation is ongoing, at least until an autopsy can be performed by the state medical examiner's office in Anchorage.
We don't have any reason to suspect foul play, but just as a precaution, we want to find out more specifically what the cause of death was.
Rosencrantz says police have not yet been able to contact anyone who may have seen Tennyson before he died. He says there were liquor and beer bottles found in his room, along with a small amount of marijuana. Officials from Discovery Communications Incorporated, the parent company of Discovery Channel, did not return phone calls in time for this story, but said in a statement that the company is, quote, saddened by the passing of Time Bandit crew member Justin Tennyson, and we send our sympathies to his entire family and fellow crew members during this most difficult time. Tennyson is survived by his father, sister, grandparents, and two children, a son and a daughter. On his Facebook page Wednesday, Time Bandit Captain Jonathan Hillstrand wrote, quote, life is short. Be sure to tell everyone you love them. Justin loved his kids very much and will really be missed. Rosencrantz says Homer police are getting an unusual amount of press inquiries about the case from all over the country.
We pretty much explain what we can. We try not to speculate to any extent and just give out the facts. I'm sure we'll be able to give more information to the various media groups that are contacting us when we get the autopsy results.
Rosencrantz says autopsy results from the medical examiner's office typically come back in less than a week. In Homer, I'm Aaron Selbig.
All but two teams still competing in the 2011 Iron Dog Snow Machine Race are at the halfway point in Nome. From KNOM, Lorelei Kanin reports.
4 minutes separated the first three teams that arrived in Nome last night in the 2011 Iron Dog Snow Machine Race, and it was team number 14, Mark McKenna and Dusty Van Meter, who won the Gold Rush Prize and will pocket $10,000 for being the first to Nome. Van Meter said they were able to make up time out of Unalakleet thanks to Todd Palin and Eric Quam.
What really saved us was the fact that those guys behind us here had to break a lot of trail. And we really put a move on and rode really hard, and we caught them. They did three quarters of the trail by themselves, and then we broke the last half and just basically had a good ride all the way through. Everything was smooth till about Topcock back there.
Van Meter and McKenna arrived in Nome at 7:41 last night. Todd Palin and Eric Quam arrived 3 minutes later, with last year's champions Tyler Huntington and Chris Olds arriving 4 minutes behind the leaders. Old said they had a good run yesterday from Unalakleet on up to Nome.
You know, we had a couple little mishaps, but overall it was a pretty good run. We started charging pretty hard after White Mountain, but decided to kind of back off a little bit because the visibility was really bad, and we just wanted to keep our stuff together, so we backed off and we had a good run after that.
All machines that arrived in Nome last night and through this morning looked really good and intact. Whether or not a team's machine is holding up at this point is really important because the wrench time is on the clock. The time racers work on their machines is added to their departure time out of Nome tomorrow. However, three-time champion Dusty Van Meter says most racers are doing minimal wrenching work thanks to a number of storms that have hit the past few weeks.
There ain't the same beating on the machine when you got all that fluff snow going through. And, you know, normally we're going a lot faster through some of those tough sections, and you just couldn't because it was such soft snow you'd fall off one way or the other. So usually that's where you see a lot more carnage in the race, is that guys bounce off and hit trees and that type of stuff. And the snow was so deep we were crawling through places that we're really moving through normally.
And it looks like the teams will face more of the same. At 4 o'clock this afternoon, the Weather Service announced a winter storm warning for this area that lasts until 6 p.m. Friday. Again, teams will remain in Nome for the banquet that is currently taking place at the National Guard Armory. The restart will begin tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock, and teams are scheduled to finish in Fairbanks on Saturday. Reporting in Nome, I'm Lorelei Kanin.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ANSEP, the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, where every year Alaska Natives from all corners of the state graduate and become engineers, scientists, and physicians. students can get involved as early as middle school, then move to the University of Alaska Anchorage, Fairbanks, or Southeast in a program based on skill building, collaboration, and community. Learn more at ANSEP.net. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2011 PFD and consider sharing a portion with your favorite charity through Pick, Click, Give. More information at alaska.pfd.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Alaska has been a prime nesting ground for birds for a long, long time, at least 70 million years to be more exact. A paleontologist with the Museum of Nature and Science in Texas recently identified two new prehistoric bird species who spent time in the area that is now Denali National Park. APRN's Annie Feit has the story.
Over the last 70 million years or so, the rock formations in Denali National Park squished together in just the right way to perfectly preserve lots of fossilized bird tracks.
The diversity of fossil bird tracks in the Cantwell Formation of Denali National Park is second to none anywhere in the world.
Paleontologist Tony Fiorillo gets a little worked up talking about fossils in Denali. He uses phrases you probably never expected to hear, like paleontological candy store.
Denali has just proven candy riches beyond our expectations. We have discovered literally thousands upon thousands of fossil footprints of a variety of different kinds of animals.
In a paper published in December in the Journal of Systematic Paleontology, Fiorillo describes two new prehistoric bird species he identified in the park.
I love the symmetry of it in that we named a very big bird and a very small bird.
The big bird is called
Magnoavipes denaliensis. And based on the tracks and studying the anatomy preserved in the tracks, we feel that this bird was I suppose the best modern example would be a very large crane. Something on the order of a whooping crane.
And the smaller bird?
Gruapeta vagrandionis. And it references a set of small tracks that we found, something a bit smaller than your average sandpiper.
The tracks from the two new bird species were found alongside the well-preserved tracks of four other prehistoric birds that had already been discovered. Fiorillo says many of the tracks have also been identified in North America and Asia. He says that means the birds were likely using Alaska as a nesting ground.
It tells us that Alaska seems to have served that role for at least the last 70 million years, that it was a good place for birds to come and nest.
Fiorillo says the journal article is based on summer research from 2007 to 2009. He says last year's field work yielded even more finds, and he says he can't wait to get back to Denali National Park this summer.
Every year we go in there, every year we find new things, and every year we come out and we have to readjust the models that we come up with. And that's what makes it so exciting, is, you know, we haven't even begun to hit the point where the data are hitting a plateau. So every year is an exciting new opportunity to find something different.
Fiorillo says Alaska seems to have been a very rich ecosystem 70 million years ago, with dinosaur fossils from the North Slope to the southeast part of the state. And he hopes to extend his work to other national parks and preserves in Alaska, like Yukon Charlie and Wrangell St. Elias. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Bears getting into trash cans has long been a problem in Sitka, but in recent years it seems to have gotten worse. The city wants to test out a new program where residents in the Indian River Road neighborhood take their garbage to a centralized neighborhood site with stronger trash cans. The Sitka Assembly received a briefing last night from members of the group devising the project. KCAW's Ed Ronco reports.
The containers would be located in a centralized area that's convenient to neighborhood residents. And rather than putting trash in individual trash cans on the curb, residents would take their garbage to that centralized area. The plan is to run the project from April through October. Here's why. In 2007, Sitka police received 181 bear calls. That number dipped to 48 in 2008, and then shot up to 240 in 2009. Last year, there were 214 bear calls.
You don't want to get
too carried away when you see the increase in numbers.
Phil Mooney is the wildlife biologist in Sitka with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
It's because we're actually getting a better response from the general public out there. They're calling in and saying, I've got a bear here. It's not particularly doing anything. You don't need to send anybody. You don't need to respond. I just want you to be aware that it's here.
Despite Mooney's warning to take the numbers in stride, he says it's important to act now to better manage trash in the city and cut down on the number of bears who find themselves feasting on the all-you-can-eat buffet that Sitkins serve up in their trash cans.
You can't go after this and make substantial progress if you only deal with it when the bear has already shown up in your yard and gotten into your garbage. So I know this system that we're talking about right now is different, a lot different than what has been used for before, where we've looked at individual trash cans to address that problem.
But there's a model for it, say the members of the Bear Task Force. The town of Canmore, Alberta, has tried the centralized garbage plan. After 300 bear sightings in 1998, the town eliminated curbside garbage collection. There were still bear sightings in 1999, but there wasn't a single report of bears getting into garbage. But there were challenges. Residents were leaving large trash items like mattresses and chairs beside the containers, and the containers attracted graffiti and some litter. City Public Works Director Michael Harmon agreed that Sitka could share some of those challenges if it decides to go after this program, but he said the cons are also balanced with pros, including increased collection, maybe three times a week. Harmon says the Indian River subdivision was chosen because it gets a lot of bear traffic and because of its geography.
It's pretty isolated in that it sits by itself, so you don't have a lot of intermixing of a densely populated neighborhood around it, so it really can be a decent study area to see if we truly made a trash-resistant area, how the bears would behave and how effective that would be.
Assembly members had a few questions, including this one from Tor Christensen.
Has anybody spoken to the folks in this area? Have we had a community meeting or anything like that?
That's planned, Harmon says, but first the city wants to test the cans on the bears at Fortress of the Bear and then have that meeting to get comments from residents and make any changes based on those comments. The assembly would have to approve the pilot project before anything happens in the Indian River subdivision, and that would come after those public meetings. Centralized trash collection is just one in a series of things the Bear Task Force hopes to do to stem the tide of bears coming into town. Other efforts would include education and better enforcement. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Tim Ellis and Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Aaron Selbig in Homer, Lorelei Kanin in Nome, and Ed Ronco in Sitka. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Kristen Spack. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. If you are an individual owner of Indian Trust land, an IIM account holder, or heir to an Indian Trust landowner or account holder, you may be eligible to receive money from a $3.4 billion federal settlement. To get a detailed written notice about the settlement that explains your legal rights, you may visit IndianTrust.com or call 1-800-961-6109. This message is sponsored by the Native American Trust. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.